Hi, I'm Tyra G, your host of Frankly Speaking with Tyra G. Welcome again to our virtual global gathering of phenomenal listeners. Yes, you. Fearsome and generous, humble and honest in pursuit of new possibilities and purpose. Every week, we meet at this table for an hour to experience, inspire, educate, encourage, and empower each other through our joys and, yes, our lessons learned. We share topics that tradition tells us there are just some things we do not talk about. But here at this table, we live beyond both the judgment and the wreckage. We share some aha moments and stories that have been left in our pockets for way too long. Every week, we start right where we are. Although many of your voices will speak light into darkness, there is no insignificant person around the table. However, you must come dressed in your inner awesome, believing that impossible is merely a word to describe the degree of difficulty. You're listening to Radio Fairfax, Fairfax, Virginia, Cablecast on Cox and Verizon Fios Channel 37 and Comcast Channel 27 in Reston and webcast worldwide on the internet at www.radiofairfax.org every Saturday evening at 8 p.m. Should you miss us, you can hear our archive, Frankly Speaking with Tyra G podcast, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Or you can visit the media room at my website, which is www.tyragarlington.com. And if you feel like reaching out to me offline, as so many of you do, email me at tyra@tyragarlington.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thank you, Courtney Nero, for composing and performing our Frankly Speaking theme song and for naming it, I'm Listening. This week, we revisit one of our most popular themes called Were It Not for Those Who Cared. I love this space because we get to meet people who work and care in places that require a servant's heart in order to reap successful outcomes for others who may be in need. To create our common thought space for today, I will ask one of my favorite questions. What if? Those two words are pregnant with possibilities. So, what if you believe the greatest service you could offer in life is to be a light on the path? Your affirmation might say, today, I'm devoted to shining the light of compassionate support and service on those who may be in need. Author Iyanla Vansant suggests in her book, Until Today, published in 2000, that at night, the ocean can be a huge, dark place. When riding the seas, you can never know for sure if the water will be calm or turbulent. You never know if you will drift off course or run aground. That is why there are lighthouses. When ships lose their way, they're guided by the lighthouse. When there's trouble or danger at sea, you can seek refuge by the White House. In the midst of a storm, the lighthouse will always guide the ship safely to the shore. Best of all, there is always someone in the lighthouse waiting. Be that someone. Be a lighthouse. Let your life be a shining symbol for others. Let everything you do be of service to someone. Stand tall in the knowledge of who you are. Stand proudly during tough times. Be aware that who you are and what you must offer can be a beacon to some lost soul. Be a lighthouse keeper. Be on the lookout for lost souls. Be alert to those who may be in need and have nowhere to go or no way to get there. Be a lighthouse to a child. Guide a child. Protect a child. You don't have to say much. Just let the child know you are there should the need arise. Be a lighthouse to an elder, someone who's traveled the sea of life, but now needs a bit of warmth and comfort, perhaps a cup of tea, and some warm, interesting conversation. Be a lighthouse to a young man or woman who's lost their footing or maybe losing their direction in life. Remember, no matter what the condition, a windblown sailor reaches the lighthouse and the keeper is always waiting. The keeper always has something on hand or knows what to do to get you up sailing again. Again, your affirmation might say, "Today I'm devoted to shining the light of compassionate support and service on those who may be in need." Joining us at the table and acting as our guide is a charming, articulate, and selfless young woman who exists to serve, protect, and empower others who live in a space that we call uncomfortable. Her service launch pad is called Samaritan House in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Please welcome Ms. Courtney Pierce, Samaritan House Anti-Trafficking Outreach and Direct Service Coordinator. And Courtney, with that, the mic is yours. Please create our latest chapter in the Human Library. Introduce yourself to our audience.
Absolutely. Tyra, thanks so much for having me. I look forward to sharing, I look forward to sharing my story with everyone and how I came into doing this incredible work with such incredible survivors. I grew up in Portsmouth, Virginia, always with a family dedicated to loving God and serving others. I went to university here and thought I would be doing work within the business sector. And when I couldn't find a job once I graduated in 2010, I started working at a local redevelopment and housing authority. And that is where I first encountered this work that we call social work and the work of serving others. And from there, I moved to the YWCA, and then I am currently at Samaritan House. And so Samaritan House is an incredible nonprofit. We are the largest federally funded anti-violence organization in the city of Virginia Beach, working with survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, homelessness, and human trafficking. I am honored to be the anti-trafficking outreach and direct service coordinator, meaning half of my job is spent doing outreach and education about the anti-trafficking movement here domestically, as well as working with funders through grants to make sure that we are being compliant with our federal funds that is given to us and anything else needed within the department. I also chair the African American Advisory Committee, and that committee is twofold. It's to create a safe space for Black, African American, and diaspora identified staff at Samaritan House, as well as serving the African-American community, doing outreach and education about violence within our community. And by underserved, we don't mean that there's something inherently wrong with Black people. We mean that there is systems in place where there is an overrepresentation of Black people dealing with traumatic events. And so that is why our committee exists.
I'm interested in that. There's so many things you said I wanted to just launch, but let me see. Let's start with the big one. Let's start with an umbrella. Let's assume that since this program is international, let's assume that you from Virginia Beach, from Samaritan House, are meeting someone from overseas that doesn't know about the problem as it exists in the United States and in Virginia. I think we're, what, number 15 in human trafficking, I think. What would you say to me?
Yes, our number does, ebb and flow.
Yeah. So what would you say to me to make me more sensitive and make me want to know more? Because, Courtney, you and I both know this is not a fun topic, And people don't sit around the dinner table with their families saying, oh, human trafficking, yes. Oh, domestic violence. No. How would you get me a little more sensitive to that area? What would you say?
Absolutely. I would say that the reason that people should be aware of violence and intimate partner violence is because most families have had an issue with it. There is a statistic that says either 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 women before the age of 18 will experience some sort of sexual violence. 1 in 4 women will experience domestic violence in their lifetime, 1 in 6 men. And so when we look at those numbers, we know that it's family members. We know that it's people that are close and near to us. We know that it could be even, you know, yourself one day. And so I think that piece of educating yourself about that, mm-hmm. Being supportive of folks. I often tell people, if you work with children, that is another place to just be aware of what that might look like in their lives.
Yes.
Because children are oftentimes affected. About 60% of the folks that we serve at Samaritan House, they have children.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are serving their children in the same capacity that we are serving them.
Well, now I took another turn. All right, so I'm that person from overseas, and aside from going, what? You mean Americans just beat up on one another? No, there are obviously systemic reasons that move families to the position where they turn inward and violent with one another. And I know that you can talk to that a bit, if you would.
Yes, absolutely. And so we oftentimes say that trauma can be very generational.
Okay.
And so what happens, yes. So what happens if you grow up in a home where violence is a part of your everyday life,
mm-hmm.
you are more than likely to continue to perpetuate those views of violence and what that might look like. So if you grew up in a home where a father may, you know, abuse or hit a mother,
uh-huh.
then that is something that you might take into a relationship or think that it's okay to have in relationships. And so oftentimes with children, things are not only taught, but they're caught. And we will often say, you know, do as I say and not as I do. But we know that that is not something that actually occurs. Most children do as they are, what they see.
Yes,
and
yes,
so,
yes.
If they're seeing that, then that oftentimes is sort of ingrained within their brain and their psyche to say, okay, well, this is how a relationship functions because this is the relationship that the adults in my life have.
And that would make sense then if you are addressing a dysfunctional family or a member with children, it would make sense that that would be a high number for the children because what they have seen, they're translating as normal and more
yes.
than likely will make that the model for relationships. So that gets me to a whole nother thing about me teaching young children, young people about worthiness, but we're not going there right now. Okay. All right. So two things. When you were talking about your job, being in a nonprofit, you said, okay, I'm doing outreach education, but I'm also working with funders. What kinds of things make a funder, when you're writing a grant, turn on to Samaritan House versus Joe Blow's house? What makes you all have such success?
Sure. So we have been around for about 36 years, and we started as a parachurch ministry when ecumenical Christian believers got together and wanted to do something about homelessness. And
okay.
they undoubtedly found that homelessness is inextricably linked to trauma, and for them, particularly domestic violence is what they saw. And so we were able to start there. Now we are a non-faith-based organization, but our values are still in serving and loving our community.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, we have an incredible track record of what we do. We document everything through tools and documentation that are very, you know, common within the social work field. So there's a program called ECM that we're able to use. We have shown funders that we can establish programs and continue to have them grow through our documentation of that. And we have shown that we have the ability to grow our organization to many employees that are able to serve in different capacities. And so really our longevity, our ability to document the work that we do, and also the ability to show real difference and change making within that documentation. So funders such as, you know, the federal government, we are funded by the Office of Victims of Crime through the Department of Justice and the Anti-Trafficking Department. We have HUD funds, so we have federal, state, and local grants. And we have an incredible director of grants that is able to sort of pull together all of the information that we provide through documentation through our programs. And she is able to write, you know, incredible grants based on our history as well as based on our projections of where we believe we should be moving to best serve survivors of violence.
And it seems to me the agencies you mentioned, DOJ, Department of Justice, HUD, federal, state, and local grants, have expectations, but those departments are also society culturally driven to, you know, they need to respond to make our society sustainable in a positive way. So what you're telling me is what you're doing is also aligning with their goals. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Because, yes, absolutely. Their goals are, you know, ultimately, you know, if we're a government, you know, we the people, the goals are based on, you know, what we're seeing and what we need in society. And so a lot of the grant solicitations are driven by that. And so, you know, we have seen an increase in funding in the anti-trafficking department because we have people that are more apt that it's here. And so I'm always very hesitant to say that there's more human trafficking happening. I'm saying it's being uncovered. We're more aware of it now.
Yes, yes. And what we used to think was abnormal behavior, now with the awareness, and I was talking to the president, which you know as well, of Anti-Trafficking International, and what he was saying, now that they have this national hotline for people like me that are not sure, they see something that's askew. If we're sensitive to it, we don't have to worry. There's a number we can call. And apparently this hotline is hooked in global or nationally. So they can, if you see it and you're in Florida, you can call and they will get in touch with police to assess and take action as necessary. And this is new. It is new because I know when the director and the COO were talking about it, this was not a part of conversations 10 years ago. And it has exploded in Virginia because we've got three airports, we've got trains, we've got money. And those are the things that seem to be driving domestic violence to work, because the person that's enslaved has no choice, but the person that's buying the service often just goes back to their lives. So it's a big, big, big hole that we're in and need to dig out of. What your role, okay, let's talk about your role. What does that title mean that you have? I know you said you do outreach and you work with funders. Do you work with staff members that are there doing the work that you talked about?
I do. Yes, we have a very, you know, tight-knit staff, and so we're able to bounce ideas off of one another. I run our programs, so I am in charge of shoring up our programs for equine therapy, for restorative yoga, and trauma-informed yoga, our art enrichment program. And so that's my job, to make sure that those, you know, are being facilitated and offered. I also do programmatic influence, meaning that decisions that are made in our department, I help to ensure that they're trauma-informed, you know, based on OVC guidelines and based on best and promising practices within the anti-trafficking world. And so I find myself doing lots of research to stay on top and abreast of things that are changing within the anti-trafficking movement, both, you know, here, you know, locally as well as nationally and internationally.
So I'm going to get back to what I think will be an interesting discussion about equine and yoga treatment to trauma. But what do you see as changing? You said you're doing a lot of research, you're staying up because this is a moving target. What are you seeing happening?
Sure. And so, Since the inception, really, of, you know, working with survivors of domestic violence, Samaritan House has had the empowerment model. And probably about 20 years ago, we went to the voluntary model as well, meaning that all of our services are free and voluntary.
Okay.
And we worked with the empowerment model, meaning that we serve survivors for their request. So, for example, we want to make sure that survivors have the ability to have agency and autonomy, as well as making sure that their voices are heard. And so we never pressure program participants into doing anything that they, you know, don't deem as appropriate for them. And so for us, it's really important to have those services sort of offered to them, and then they decide what services, or if any, that they participate in. And so I am seeing lots of work continuing around that vein in the anti-trafficking world, being very progressive within our programs. So a day-to-day program for a survivor that's in one of our shelters looks very different than the next survivor.
Okay.
Yes. So that is what I mean by progressive. We don't have standard programming, because standard programming is not going to work for each person.
Right.
So we really try to tailor programming based on what a program participant needs. So, for example, we have substance use treatment, but that's not offered that's not needed for every survivor. Every survivor doesn't want to take part in substance use treatment. We have, like I said before, we have trauma-informed yoga, but not everyone wants to do yoga. So whoever wants to do that, they're able to come, you know, and take part in that program. And who doesn't, you know, they're able to find something else that might fit them better. But, yeah, so that's what I enjoy about the program, is that it's very focused on autonomy and choice. And that is because so many of our survivors have never had that. They've been told, you know, what to do, where to go, who to service. And so for us, we want to act as someone who is creating a space for survivors to think about, what is it that I want to do? Who is it that I want to be, you know, based on who I am and not based on what others are telling me?
So, Courtney, interesting, just flash I had as you were talking. If I am someone, a victim of domestic violence, I have been told. All right, now I'm in a safe environment with Samaritan House. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to get to what I want. How do you,
absolutely,
as staff, walk me through the point that empowers me to say, well, I don't want to do this, but I do want to do this, and I know they have to do something. So how do you work with them coming through the door? You're going to have to change a paradigm and a mindset to help them know it's okay to choose or refuse, right?
Absolutely. And so one of the things about being an advocate is, the first thing for me is education.
Okay.
And so I think that education is extremely powerful. And so for me, what I do as an advocate is I educate program participants on what the options are.
Okay.
So, for example, if we have a program participant who is interested in furthering their education.
Mm-hmm.
So education looks different for everyone. It could look like a vocational school. It could look like a trade school. It could like a community college. It could be an online program. And so we sit down and we talk about all of those options, and I educate the program participant on all those options. And then we give the program participant some time, you know, to think about what it is that they would like. And then they come back and say, you know what, Courtney, I'm really interested in learning about welding.
Okay.
And so we say, oh, we have a great partnership with an organization that can do that, you know, free of charge to you. That program starts in, you know, in 3 weeks. Is that something that you're interested in? And they say yes. And sometimes they'll get into a program and it might not be a great fit. You know,
okay,
very similar to anyone else. You know, we've all started something and found out that it might not be a great fit. And then we go back to the drawing board.
Okay.
So it's lots of trial and error. But the beauty in that to me is when I see a program participant able to make a choice on their own and on their own volition and see it and follow it through, or decide that they're going to follow a different path. I just like having the ability to see them make choices for their own selves, you know, free of coercion or force, you know, or frauding them in any way.
Absolutely. And I know behaviorally that changing behavior is a process and not an event. So that gets me to time frames. All right. So I come to Samaritan House and what? I can be in a safe house. Tell me, what are my options? Because the person that we're trying to to empower to make choices. Is that person an outpatient, but a client that comes to you, or a client that is there, or a client that's going to a partner? I want to talk about partnerships. Don't let me forget. Okay. But how does that work?
Sure. So it works differently for depending on how that person finds us. So I will work with, you know, we'll say, for example, Homeland Security and local law enforcement, because they are a part of our partnership.
Okay.
And so we do receive many of our program participants through operations that are done by Homeland Security, or our TFO officers, our task force officers with the Hampton Roads Human Trafficking Task Force. We are the victim services provider for the south side of Virginia,
okay,
the Hampton Roads area. And so, say, for example, someone comes in through HSI and they are looking for shelter because they don't have safe housing. We work with them in shelter. If someone comes to us through Homeland Security and they have a safe place to stay, we also serve community clients. So we serve sheltered clients and community clients.
Okay. This is what I needed. Yeah. Okay. So we have people that are there locally or wherever they are, sheltered, and we have clients coming from the community to you, right?
Or to, yes.
Okay.
Well, we have clients that live safely in the community, just like you and I. They live in an apartment, they live in a house. They're safe in their community, but we are able to offer them services, and that's why they're called community clients as opposed to sheltered clients, because they're not living in one of our shelters.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yes, they're not living in one of the funded shelters that Samaritan House has, which is 14 undisclosed shelters in the city of Virginia Beach.
Yes, and we understand why they're undisclosed. Okay, yes. Now, on the community clients, and this gets me to how do you measure success? All right, I'm a client, and I'm sheltered safely in the community, and I really have had traumatic experiences in the past. And I come to you because you told me about, let's use the yoga program. Okay, what would I get? What would happen then?
Sure, so you would be assigned a case manager. And from that case manager, you'll have an initial meeting. So for our trafficking survivors, the first 30 days, we're not looking for much out of our trafficking survivors, meaning we are looking for them to be able to sleep at night and wake up during the morning and just regulate their body schedule, because many of our program participants come from sleeping during the day and then working. And by working, I mean serving people doing forced sex work or forced labor work during the night. And so we want to be able to have our program participants have their schedules regulated. And so that's one of the things that we're just offering that. And so we work with a four-phased program. And so, you know, during those first 30 days, we do talk about services that we offer. And then we will ask if any of those folks are interested in any of those services. And if they say, yes, Courtney, I'm interested in trauma-informed yoga, then we would say, okay, these are the days that we have that. And if you would like to sign up, we can sign you up. And we will provide transportation there and back and all of the equipment that's needed. And so other than them expressing that information, expressing them wanting to come, there's not much that they have to do in addition.
So I'm hearing several things. I am hearing you're providing provision. I'm hearing that you provide what they need. I'm also hearing there's a holistic approach to this. I absolutely am thrilled. It's the first time I've heard, and it's probably because I haven't read it yet, that you spend the first 30 days them regulating their systems out of what they had to do as human slavery and back to what might be a normal system, where if they look for a job, it would make sense. They sleep at night and they go to the job in the day versus what they'd been doing, right?
Yes.
So that makes me segue into employment. Talk to me about how, I guess this has to do with your partnerships, but talk to me about how you find jobs, how you match these clients up with jobs, how you manage their sustainability. We know that they're vulnerable and tender, so we can expect some recidivism back into whatever. But talk about that, employment opportunities, and how you guide them through that.
Sure. And so one of the things is many of our program participants come to us with, you know, particular skill sets, but some of them don't, depending on their age and their, you know, previous background that they've had.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we do is, you know, again, going back to the education piece, going back to the, you know, asking questions of them and
mm-hmm.
what is it that they can do and what is it that they feel comfortable doing and, you know, does working sound like an option right now as they work through, you know, their trauma. And so we have partnerships with our local job force developments. We have partnerships with other nonprofits that do vocational work. And so for us, we lean on those partnerships, but we also, you know, will case managers who do so much in our department, they will, you know, help support program participants through resume writing.
Okay.
Help to file for those jobs, take them on their interviews. We provide clothing for them to be able to, if they have a uniform or a dress code at their jobs. And so, you know, anything that they need to be able to, you know, successfully enter the workforce is something that we support and can help to provide.
I'm sitting here grateful. Not so much impressed as grateful that there's a place mm-hmm. called Samaritan House that you have, you are looking at the total human being. And it seems that your case managers, tell me about them. How are they trained? How do you recruit them? What kind of education or experience, professional experience, do they bring to Samaritan House with them? Talk about that a little bit, please.
Sure. So many people that work within the field that we work in are human services majors. They have social work degrees or degrees in psychiatry or psychology.
Mm-hmm.
So we really have varied backgrounds. Some of us have a lot of experience without that, you know, educational background piece.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really does depend. But we are an organization like anyone else. We are a nonprofit. So, you know, we are a part of other nonprofit networks. And so oftentimes people will find us via there. They can find, you know, jobs on Indeed or on our website. And so that is how we, you know, work to, you know, support folks. We all have to have a 40-hour training at Samaritan House that we do ourselves. So we train one another in our various areas of expertise, and we keep up with our education for about 20 hours a year. Doing that. And a part of our job is so much learning on the job.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a case manager and one of your program participants needs to file for Social Security, well, now here's an opportunity. You learn how to file for Social Security. And so we have had folks that have been in our field for many, many years. And so as you can imagine, the work that we do is very difficult. But our coworkers, we really have one another's back, and we're, you know, we make sure that we are able to support one another. And that is one of the beauties of working in, you know, at Samaritan House, but also just within the field, is we know that we can't do our jobs alone. And so we know we need each other's support, and we are readily, to, you know, available to give that to one another.
I'm also hearing the possibility for burnout among these wonderfully
yes.
trained people. I had a tad of experience when I was on a clinical staff at one point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just seeing, at least for me, the tendency was to be so committed and had a difficult time managing professional distance because I wanted to help. And the other piece of that is, and this is one I'll lay on the table for you, is how do you all deal with or support one another through a failure experience with one of your clients?
Sure. And so that is a beautiful thing in the sense that, you know, due to confidentiality,
mm-hmm.
Most of the times the only thing, you know, the only folks we can speak to are one another.
Yes.
We encourage at our organization and just within the field to have self-care. We encourage, you know, seeing your own mental health, you know, provider and therapist. I know I really have enjoyed the sessions I've had with my therapist through the years of
mm-hmm.
just working in this field and being able to lean on them for support. Also, we really, that empowerment model really helps to shield, you know, us as employees from being too invested. And what I mean by that is we are incredibly invested in working with survivors.
Okay.
But we are not so invested that if a program participant makes a decision that we don't agree with, mm-hmm. that we're upset with the program participant or in any way. I always like to say only one person can be in a crisis at a time. And so right now, our program participants, they are in crisis.
Yes.
And so I cannot be in crisis with them. I need to be level-headed and understand what that empowerment model looks like and really understand that whether or not a program participant makes a choice that I might personally agree with, it's still my job to support them. And it really does sort of release the reins of caring too much, meaning where I'm caring where it's harming them.
I get you. I'm
imposing my views on them yet.
I get that. I really do. And I think that was so well stated. By employing an empowerment model, you don't have to assume responsibilities for choices. You are
because it is our program providers.
Yes.
It's our survivors' job to make those decisions for themselves, and
yes.
our job is to support that.
That is awesome. And I don't know how many programs do that. I need to know probably.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that is a critical success factor for both the provider and the client. I would ask, as we were talking, another thought, what kind of medical partnerships do you have?
Sure. And so we work with a lot of our incredible, like, local organizations that do work. So Sentara Hospital,
mm-hmm.
CHKD, the, you know, Children's of the King's Daughters Hospital, Chesapeake Care Clinic, and any other local, you know, organization or medical provider that, you know, is very trauma-informed and they know how to serve survivors of violence, we welcome those partnerships. And we have just been able to, you know, really serve program participants by helping them and funding, because we pay for medical and dental in
okay.
our anti-trafficking department. And so they don't have to pay for, you know, checkups or, as you can imagine, a lot of our program participants come to us not having had regular dental or medical care.
Right.
And so that's
right.
one of the first things that is established, is taking them to the doctor
mm-hmm.
and getting them checked out by a professional who knows how to work with someone who's been traumatized in that way.
Talk about your thinking about medical, and I'm thinking, all right, do any of your clients come as victims of any of these violence scenarios pregnant?
Yes, we do. When we first started the program, we had about 4 program participants that were all pregnant. And so we had lots of little ones running around. And
I mean, I'm just visualizing, you know, the program and these babies feeling empowered, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So we have, you know, served program participants with 1 child all the way up to 11 children.
What?
And so, yes. So we most certainly see, you know, a person that has children as a whole family unit.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you come, your children come, and we're able to support them as well.
Yeah, I'm understanding why you're getting money from DOJ, HUD, federal, state, and local, because you are dealing in reality rather than a dream state. I had said something earlier. I put a question mark. Talk about the equine program. What's going on there?
Sure. And so we have been working with a couple of folks within the equine program. Barb is one of the instructors that we work with, EquiKids. And so what we do is for that, it looks different. Sometimes we've done groups and sometimes we've just done a single person. But really, it's about tending and caring for, you know, the grounds and the horses.
Okay.
Much in the ways that you as a program participant weren't cared for. And it's about getting out in nature, as we know that that can be very therapeutic. And so we have had program participants really enjoy it. And then we had some that, you know, it wasn't their cup of tea. And so that's the beauty of getting out and trying something new, where you're able to find out what, you know, therapeutic treatment might work best for you as a program participant.
So I'm hearing you say that the equine program is about caring for something other than yourself.
Yes.
A grounds, an environment, an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm thinking through that process, a bonding can occur for the person doing
absolutely.
The caring. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that is absolutely, positively wonderful. I wanted to also understand, you started talking about in the very beginning about underserved groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's go there and sit there for a while. And what are we talking about? Certain groups, marginalization, what are we talking about?
Sure. And so one of the incredible things that we do at Samaritan House, which other organizations do as well, is we talk about that data piece. So we capture that data. And so from federal information domestically, we are right on track, meaning that we have seen these underserved populations within our communities. And so we created three underserved populations. One is for the Black and African American community. The other is for LGBTQ identified folks, and the other is for older adults and differently abled folks. And so those three populations we have seen, they have higher rates of harm and trauma, and oftentimes they are not addressed appropriately. And that is due to the marginalization within society for those particular communities, as well as noting that many of those people in those communities are intersectional. Say, for example, if you have an older Black adult who mm-hmm. is differently abled, who is experiencing violence in their home.
Okay.
So that is a cross-section of at least two of those, two of those populations that we speak of. Or if you have a trans Black youth,
okay.
you know, you have someone who is trans
mm-hmm.
and they are Black and they are a youth. And so we talk about the ways that many of our committees are intersectional. And so it's important for us to be able to work together as committees, but then also be able to speak directly to the victimization of that specific committee that we're working with or working on. And so I'm really honored to chair the Black and African American Advisory Committee. We recently had a Black men's town hall, which was incredible. We heard from 13 Black men, and they were incredibly vulnerable. And they talked about, you know, what violence, you know, has brought and what they have seen violence look like and how they can, you know, be allies within the fight to, you know, to stamp out domestic violence. And so it was incredible just to listen to them speak.
What are some of the things, the stories that they shared? You know, like, obviously I heard you say that they saw some things they could do. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they talked about, you know, being the example for younger men that they might not have seen, or they talked about how incredible their fathers were in breaking, you know, that curse between the generations of being, you know, present and being vulnerable and being open. And they hope to, you know, carry that on to their own, you know, children, as well as influencing, you know, young Black men that they have access to within their communities. And so they were very vulnerable and very candid. And as anyone, I think, knows about men, oftentimes men don't have the space to be vulnerable. I love this quote from Bell Hooks. She says that when men don't have the space to be vulnerable, or they're not given the ability to be vulnerable, they turn to violence.
Oh, absolutely. And yes.
Yeah, it would behoove us
yes.
as a society to make that space for them.
But most of us don't have that in our language. You know, and I was looking at Brené Brown and leadership, but I remember the first time I really became attached to her, yes, was when she was talking about how strong you have to be vulnerable.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you got to release the power that you're holding on to. And it makes sense. But men, because of what the culture has, what tradition has said, a man is, a man does, a man thinks, a man feels, A, B, C, D, there's really no room. And when they feel vulnerable, they're not familiar with that concept. And that's a threat. So when you're threatened, you find a way to respond. And often I think it is violence. And, oh, that is so sad. That is so sad. I was reading I was on your website, and I was reading a story. I was in it was a letter written by a domestic violence survivor. And her neighbor had been concerned because of what she heard within the apartment. And her neighbor and her neighbor's husband saw on the street the woman and her husband, and he was beating her and dragging her by the hair. And the neighbor's husband said, "We don't want to get involved." And but the neighbor, praise God, said, no, this is no good, when she saw her just lying on the street. So I'm saying to myself, how often does this happen? Then I say to myself, for real, what would you do, Tyra? What would you do in that circumstance? And I don't know whether people openly talk about what you could do or strategies for reducing mm-hmm. stress, or, you know, is that a part of the program? Is that, I'm sure it is.
Yes, we talk about, you know, ways we can support others in the community.
Yeah.
So we often talk about the same model that you use on an airplane. So you have to put the oxygen mask on yourself first.
And yes.
So we encourage people to stay safe first themselves.
Yes.
And to see how they can de-escalate the situation based on their own personality type, based on, you know, how they, you know, how well they know the person or the safety issue. Mm-hmm. We encourage people, if they feel comfortable, to, you know, implore law enforcement. You know, as myself personally, I'm a really big proponent of community accountability and restorative justice and transformative justice work, and ways that we as communities can de-escalate situations. I remember seeing, it was a couple, it was two women actually, one was in the military, and their argument had escalated, and they were screaming and yelling at, you know, in one another's face. And I, you know, went over to them because I felt, you know, safe enough to approach them from a distance. And I said, hey, is everything okay? And, you know, one of the ladies, she, you know, was teary-eyed and told me, you know, what was going on. And so I asked if I could approach. They said I could. And we just basically had a conversation about, you know, communication skills. And they both wanted to stay in that relationship, but they felt like they weren't healthy for one another. And so I was able to give some referrals, mm-hmm. counseling. And so, again, that situation was not, I was not harmed in that situation. And the situation wasn't physically violent. It was emotionally violent. So I will say that that was one of the cases where I, as a community member, I did, you know, community advocacy. I held them accountable via their community without involving anyone else. And I'm not saying that that's how every situation is going to fare out. And I will say that even, you know, for law enforcement, they note that some of the most violent calls that they've ever gone out on are domestic violence calls.
That's what, yes. Mm-hmm. And also, when you were talking about that, we have the label domestic violence, and right away mm-hmm. people translate that into physical, and they yes. don't understand that domestic violence is so much greater than that in terms of mental and isolating, you know. And
yes.
I imagine
domestic violence, yes, it's also not just intimate partner violence. So domestic violence is the umbrella, and intimate partner violence comes under the umbrella, but domestic violence could be a mother and a daughter fighting.
Yeah,
live in
yeah,
the same
yeah.
home. It could yeah. be a father and a son. And so, you know, family members in that way where they live together. But yes, we have seen many program participants not only endure physical violence, but years of emotional violence by name calling and
uh-huh.
putting down one's character,
mm-hmm.
and so, which can take years and years of work to really undo those thought patterns that have been established within our brains.
And I'm thinking, when I first started right out of college, my goal, I was taught first, then second, then third grade. And I noticed the difference between my first graders and my third graders in terms of mm-hmm. parenting, getting all the way back to the beginning of our discussion, what those children had caught from their home environment.
Yes, absolutely.
And
even as young as they are.
Yes. And they were the terminology, which was highly inappropriate for a third grader, okay? The vocabulary, and you know, I obviously wanted to explore, and the things they were seeing at home, which they considered normal. So speaking
yes.
them, there was nothing wrong with that, sharing with their and yelling at their classmates that way. And of course, that led to other kinds of interventions. But I quickly want to, I'm thinking, I don't know whether you want to come back, but there's just so much going on, and I don't want to leave the program. What about you? Where are you going with this? You are passionate, and you are driven and you are wonderful. What are you doing with yourself? What's your next step?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm currently pursuing a master's degree at Western New Mexico University in social work. And my goal is to dip my toe in traveling social work. So working, being able to travel to different communities that need support, whether that's in a hospital setting or another crisis setting. I also have a passion for restorative and transformative justice. And so I would love to work doing groups, working with people who've harmed others. And so we talk about people who've harmed others. Now, what someone has been through in their past is never an excuse to harm someone else, but it does give us a reason.
Yes.
And for those reasons, if we want to be able to serve survivors holistically, we are not going to be able to stamp out violence without actually working with people who have, you know, harmed someone. And so that really is my goal. It's very much aligned with, to me, like my faith as a Christian. And so it makes it me understand just how restorative the gospel is as a whole. And so those are my plans coming up. So I'm busy working full-time and in school, but I really am enjoying, you know, the opportunity to get educated by a great institution.
Well, I have three things to say to you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I love the model of the restorative and the transformative justice. I mean, that's something I want you to come back and talk about for a whole show, if you will.
Absolutely, I would love that.
But right now, I need you to do something for me, and that is to read the letter that you wrote to your younger self. I can't wait to hear this one.
Absolutely. And so,
you ready?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
So, dear young one, relax. Take a deep breath and breathe easy. Lean on and rest in the Father that has the whole world in his hands. Stop doing, stop performing, just be. Rest and listen. Be kind to yourself in the same way that you are to others. Be present and in the moment. Laugh loud and uninterrupted. When they come to take your blackness and beauty, think nothing more of it. When they come and question your faith and love, think nothing more of it. When they come to take your community, lean in, press in harder, push back. Let go of the hurt and keep your heart wide open like a lake. Know that the plans that you made for yourself will not see the light of day. But don't fret, the Lord is working in ways you could never imagine. You will work hard and you will love every minute of it. You will find your calling and your life's work in serving others. You will move from seeking justice to seeking restoration. You will understand the heart of the gospel as transformative and not punitive. You will understand that it's not about shame, but about sonship. You will read and fall in love with authors like James Baldwin and Toni Morrison. And you will declare that you are Black, alive, and looking back.
Is that it?
Yes.
You know what? You're also a writer. This is so fascinating. Courtney, you just have to come back. I am so pleased we had the discussion and new things to think about, particularly an empowering model for those who have been so constricted emotionally in their development, and giving them the opportunity to be a part of their healing. And I thank you, Courtney Pierce from Samaritan House, for all that you bring to the table, all that your organization brings to the table. Quickly, if someone wants to continue the conversation with you, how can they do that?
Sure. So you can visit our website, which is SamaritanHouseVA.org. And there you can inquire about, you know, meeting with someone to talk about doing outreach and education in additional ways. Or you can email me directly at Courtney P, as in Pierce, at SamaritanHouseVA.org.
Thank you so much. Everybody knows that I like to leave a little soul food on the Frankly Speaking table. Soul food that encourages for the time until the next time when you're feeling less than, empty. Yes, there is more than what you're experiencing. I want to flip that script for you for a moment. If by chance no one has told you that they love you today, I would be honored to be the first to say I love you today. I love you because you are and have been so willing to grow, and my, how you have grown. You have grown from struggling to searching, from trying to doing something to learning how to do. You've grown from fear to having faith to demonstrating your courage. You've grown in so many ways, consistently demonstrating your willingness and your courage to take the next step, the step toward the profound and divine wisdom buried within yourself, the step toward knowing more about you. That is exactly why I say, I love you. You are profoundly divine. You've been listening to Radio Fairfax, Fairfax, Virginia, Cablecast, on Cox and Verizon Fios, Channel 37 and Comcast, Channel 27 in Reston. And we are webcast every Saturday night on www.radiofairfax.org. Remember this, your seat at the table is guaranteed. I look forward to next time. Until then, remember, you're worthy. You're stronger than you feel, smarter than you think, more beautiful than you know, and more loved than you can ever imagine. You are chosen. You are important. Treat yourself like someone you love. This is Tyra G, living intentionally and loving you. Take good care. Until next time.